currently executive director at Buck. Quite a strange entry into that role. You began as a studio manager and then moved your way through creative services, operational management, became global operation manager at Gray. I have this right. I'm still going good.
A lot of different titles, okay. A lot of made up titles.
All the things. Great service manager, God, yeah. Goddess, Athena. You then move away from that into what I would describe as design consultancy / production focus / doing a bad version of this, describing Buck. But it was very different to an Adland agency. And in between that, you were also a managing director.
Correct.
That's a bad introduction. But Rachel, before we go on, I must ask you the question.
I know.
Who was the first person that made you feel like you had talent?
I love this question. And I love how everybody says mom. Wait, quick plug. I've been listening to your podcast every day since 2000.
Which makes you really happy. At least someone is.
Yeah, I am the one. And I love this question. But can I flip the script and ask a question first?
Yes.
And you can cut this out. I don't care.
No, please carry on.
I'm so curious what triggered you to ask me to be on.
Okay.
Like, what started that thought in your mind?
Wow. I've never been asked that question.
Sick.
But I can answer it really easily. So when we launched in the US, one of the things that we found was people would be in positions like yours, and they were these incredible hustlers, and they would know everybody within the industry, and they would stay in that lane. But for some reason, you didn't stay in that lane.
Yeah.
And I think the journey of your career is really interesting because A, you've taken two sabbaticals, which, like, in New York, I've never actually seen that happen. But B, you've made two quite significant changes where it would have taken self-belief, confidence, learning again, being a bit of an idiot all over again. And
idiot.
Yeah. And that's what my business, Unknown Creative Recruitment Company, it stands for people that understand their skill set is transferable and is a lateral thing. And although you are a insert title at Gray, that could also mean that you could be a director at Buck. Look at yourself and the impact that you can have on a business rather than attaching and tethering your value to an industry or to a specific part of the industry. So it's a very humbling question to ask that, but I hope, does that make sense?
Yeah, non-linear path.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what we stand for.
Yeah, great.
That makes Amazing.
Sense. Yeah.
Now you had to answer my question.
Okay, I'll get back to you. We'll talk all about that nonlinear path, I'm sure. The question of talent, who made me feel talented?
Mm.
Everybody says mom, which is definitely true. I remember a specific moment. I was making a birthday card for someone. I was probably 9, 10, 11, I don't know. And instead of making like the book shape birthday card, I made a giant cardboard star.
Okay.
Decorated, of course, glitter colors, all of it. And it would fold into itself. So then to get into it, you had to unfold it. And each panel would have a different part of our friendship story on it.
Wow.
And she loved that. She still brings it up. So she definitely championed creativity, as everyone says, as their answer.
Okay.
A lot of people say. But when I think about I feel like that was a very celebrated artifact.
Mm.
And that felt great. But what felt like even more of a proud moment was actually, I rode horses for 12 years. I know, I was a horse girl. Ah! And not in the rich snobby way. I didn't have a ton of money. But
more like you steal a horse and you run off with
totally.
It. Totally. Yeah.
Yes. And the instructor, Rita, who owned the farm, I remember I was training this horse, more training because the horses weren't expensive either.
Okay.
And so I was training this horse and I was doing our first oxer, which is a double jump.
Okay.
So they put two jumps next to each other and you have to go over the whole thing.
Ooh.
And I was getting prepared. You have to be in a mental headspace. It can be pretty dangerous. I was getting prepared to do it. You have to circle the ring a few times. And I remember circling the ring, gearing up to go towards the jump. And she said to the other student in the class, look at her eyes. That's determination.
Wow.
I know. Wow. And that stuck with me. And that was like
a Nike advert.
What?
That could be a Nike advert.
Oh, great. Nike, hit me up.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And I don't know if that's because it's like a character trait versus making something is great and creativity is great and I'm in this field. But there was something about like the deeper recognition of a character trait that I had never heard maybe.
Wow.
I don't know. It just stuck with me.
That's a really interesting answer. And it almost skips the next two questions that I would have had, which is great. Like, yeah. Well, because if you look at your career, you see someone that had to have a high level of determination. You are responsible for getting everybody to get something done, probably in a time constraint moment the whole time. And there's never really, it's like that whole thing about there never being a referee that's given the round of applause. Like you're in this, in a way, thankless position sometimes where you're constrained by both ends of the scale. And my next question was going to be, what did you know about yourself to then get into this industry? And then how did you discover this world?
How I got into the industry is fascinating.
Okay.
I definitely have a mix of determination and also just riding the wave. And like...
going with it.
Yeah, just going with it. And I remember like I got the first job out of college, which was managing a photography studio by happenstance. I was interning. They offered me the job. I'm like, great, I'll stay for a year. And ended up being like the only non-photographer in the company. So everything else, client, money, systems, operations, whatever. And I was like 20, maybe. And then I moved to LA with like a little duffel bag and nowhere to live. And I was applying to jobs on Craigslist. And I got a job offer at David and Goliath off of Craigslist. And I'd never heard of David and Goliath at the time. Like I knew all the big ones, Saatchi, Ogilvy, blah, blah, Shiat, when the big dogs were really killing it back then. Quite a shift. We'll come back to that.
Yeah.
But David and Goliath gave me an offer. Saatchi gave me an offer. Saatchi was an AAE job, so assistant account exec. David and Goliath was creative coordinator. And I took David and Goliath. I think it was like $5,000 more. Like that's how much that money meant to me at the time. And I took that and I ended up in the creative department. But because it was like a new role, they had me be receptionist for like 3 months. So I was sitting at the front desk as receptionist being like, David and Goliath, how may I help you? Like I still have that voice that I can put on. And it was so great. Like I mean, from there, I like climbed the ranks at David and Goliath pretty quickly, which was again, a bit of a ride of the wave moment because my boss went on mat leave and she didn't come back. And when she was in mat leave, the founder, David, was like, do you want to try this job out as creative services manager? I was like 22.
Wow.
And I was like, of course I do. Like, why not? Yeah. Work around the clock. And then they gave it to me when she didn't come back. So it was a lot of ride the wave.
Sliding doors moments as well, because you could have, at that point, you could have gone client services.
Yeah.
And what I find strange is client services are paid less. That's odd. Like, mm-hmm. They're recognizing operationally that the internal running of a business is valued more than the person that's on the outside selling the business.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah. It was minor difference.
Yeah.
like maybe at max 5K.
Yeah.
But yeah, I went in as a receptionist, which I kind of love because I got to see like the point of the industry back then.
Yeah.
I don't feel like that would happen now.
Yeah.
In a good way.
In which parts do you think?
Like being brought in as a young female and making them receptionist, even though that wasn't the job, technically. I mean, I loved it. Like I didn't feel any sort of way about it.
No.
But I don't think that would happen now.
No, I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah.
So what was it about that then? So like, I like asking the question, when do you remember losing track of time? Like, was there a thing that you were doing at that time where you're like, wow, this is what I was meant to be doing?
God, I mean, I feel like fast forward to pitching days when you could just so easily lose track of time.
But in a good way?
Literally.
Or? Yeah, yeah.
You're just working around the clock. I don't know that I ever had a moment where I'm like, this is what I'm meant to be doing.
Really?
I did have a moment where, yeah, no, because some people wake up and they're like, I know what I want to do right out of the womb. I am not that person. And part of why I ended up in this field is I'm non-committal. So
okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But I do remember my mom noticing something or me asking my mom a question. Yeah. So I was studio manager right out of college. And then I went to David and Goliath, ended up in a management role there, even though so much of it is riding the wave
and
happenstance seemingly. of course, hard work goes into it, blah, blah, blah. But she, I asked her, like, I was like 22 sitting on the management table. And I was like, how does this happen? Like, why does this keep happening? And she was executive director of a nonprofit for 30 years after being an occupational therapist. Wow. And she just kind of said really off the cuff, like, some people are just meant to manage, and those ones end up in management. And I was like, you know, I was 22 years old. And I was like, what?
Yeah. Because that is young. Like, and I resonate with that as well.
It's really young.
When I was, I was 22. I remember letting a lady who had a daughter, she asked me if she can go home to pick her up from work. I was like, why am I in charge of that decision? What is going on? But I think you're right. But also there's an inverse to that, which is not everybody should become a manager.
Totally.
And there are so many, particularly in your world, you have so many brilliant, creatively talented people, design, whatever they, you know, their skill set is. And they're really good. They get to their mid to late 20s or whatever age they're at. And they go, cool, you're really good at this. Here are five other people to manage.
Yep.
And none of the skill sets or any training at all in, because maybe 10 or 20% is getting them to be good at creative or design. The rest is letting them go pick their daughter up from school or figuring out if they have a mental health problem or, you know, what to do about this last minute problem. Like, there are so many things.
It's so different. A lot of that. Yeah. Oh, that's another point on like the time back then and how it was different. It was also, I like saw cocaine on the tables when I started, and I feel like those days have also ceased. I'm very grateful I got to see it for a minute. Yeah. You know, I think it was just that one year.
Was it just like we're pitching? How else are we going to do this? Somebody get some cocaine in, or was it like
no? It was just
habitual use.
Yeah, it was just in it. It's just habitual for whoever. I didn't do it at the time, but like I remember seeing like, you know, white dust on the tables and then fast forwarding to like being in the gray days where that had ceased.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm kind of grateful I saw it in a weird way.
Weird.
You've seen so much change and I feel like I appreciate that change.
It's funny you mentioned grey. I think the grey London days, that carried on for a while.
Nils, are you listening?
Yeah. So, okay, take me from there. So David and Goliath, then on to where?
Grey.
Straight on to grey.
I guess I freelanced at Tommy Hilfiger for a bit.
Yes.
But great. So this is how David led to my grey days. Yeah. He connected me to Susan Kirschenbaum, who's a recruiter here. Mm-hmm. Really established recruiter. Love her. She's like the Jewish mom you never had, even though I have one.
Okay.
And I remember meeting with her. It was the first intro. David had connected us. And she brought up Gray. Mm. And I was like, no. Like, I hate that agency. There's no other agency I hate more.
Why?
Do not say that name to me. Because at the time, Gray was terrible. I think it was publicly a press headline the year before, Gray is where creative careers go to die.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So it was really widely known as bad.
I'm being called Gray as well.
I'm being called, people would joke all the time. It's just like boring as the wall, the color on the walls.
Oh.
What a name on the door. Yeah. So I was like very against it, but to her credit, she was like, she really clued in to what would get me to walk through that door, and that's all it took.
Mm.
She was like, one of her best friends was Tor. Do you know that name?
Yeah.
So she was like, he just started. For listeners, he changed Gray entirely, and now he's CMO of Apple, and he's just one of those next level leaders now. Mm. At the time, he was no name.
No.
And she was like, this guy just started. He's going to change everything about Gray. I have full faith in him. That didn't sell me. But she was like, they'll talk to you right now. You don't have to print a resume, and you don't have to put on an interview outfit.
Wow.
Sold. I will go.
Back in the beachwear.
Back in it. Like, don't have to do the hair.
Yeah.
Don't do the, yeah. So I walked through and immediately just like fell in love.
With what?
It was the office, the vibe. It was beautiful. They had just, Tor had a big hand in designing it.
Yeah.
Stunning. The people I met were really awesome. You could just feel this, the potential had not been reached. It was like the new energy. It was the underdog still. And you could just kind of feel it. So then I tapped into my determination. I was like, I will work at Gray. I interviewed like seven times.
Seven times?
Yeah.
Before taking it?
Before getting it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, so it was competitive?
Oh, yeah.
What was the problem that you were going to solve?
I mean, I was still a junior. So not a huge problem to solve, but they were building up project management and he was really behind that. Like it was creative project management and they were really, it's a very different role, cross agency, cross company, but at Gray in that time, he wanted them to be the linchpin of everything. So like the person bringing together the different departments to make shit happen and protecting the creative work from any kind of noise or too much like account management involvement, which was a problem back then.
Like, when did you start to realize? Because it sounds like you had a good time there. It sounds like that was a fun.
Yeah.
You took something from something to something else.
Yeah.
Globally.
Globally.
Gray changed completely. Yeah. Right? A, tell me, when did you know that it had changed from being the Gray that you knew before?
Okay. So they started doing great work. I was working in the New York office with him. I started working really closely with Tor very fast, probably in the first like 6 months, because I raised my hand for new business. We started winning a lot. That started to change stuff. But then the Gillette pitch came in as an opportunity. And I didn't know this at the time, but it was going to be the biggest pitch for like 30 years, 20 to 30 years. Yeah, Jesus. It was enormous. And we were the total underdog. And BBDO had the account for 84 years. And I didn't think there was any way we were going to get it.
84 years?
Yeah, 84 years.
Holy shit.
Or 86. Yeah, one of those.
Wow.
And yeah, I was like, even from my project management brain was like, even moving that number of assets is never going to happen. But we won it. It was 9 months long, which also doesn't happen now.
Oh my God.
And it was, we briefed 141 creatives globally from day one in October.
What? For how many ideas? Like, what's the output of 140 creative people?
Yeah. I mean, we went on. It was 9 months. We had multiple rounds, many ideas. I don't even remember how many platforms we ended up with. Maybe three in the final, final round.
Three ideas.
Three big
140,
platforms.
140. Well, yeah. Okay,
yeah.
140 creative people.
Yeah.
But you just think about, like, even if you just listen to that, if you were explaining that to an alien that landed on this planet and you went, we're going to get, you know, we've got 140 of these humans walking around. There's a brand that's like about shaving. They want an
three.
You want three ideas. Yeah. They'd be like, what are you doing with that many people?
I know. It sounds crazy. And it doesn't happen now, you know?
No, like I know, but you can understand why.
Yeah, totally. You can understand why. 100%. Anyway, bringing in that pitch changed the whole global network because it was just... It was great work. They basically wanted to air what we made in the pitch, which never happens. And it was a ton of money. So it just transitioned the whole company. And that was when he brought me to the global team. And that's when I did a global role.
What does that mean then? So what changes about your life when you go from being national into a global position? What changed?
Everything.
Everything.
Because it's, you're looking at like the perspective of it. When you're in one office, you're looking so deep into the weeds on how stuff gets done on the ground. And then when you're in a global role, talking to anywhere from like 55 offices the first year to 85 offices by the third year, you have to think so like what's going to work across all these different types of companies, because they weren't even all what I would call ad agencies. There were many, I would say like 14 affiliate companies. Some of them were ad agencies. Some of them were more like production studios. Some of them were design. And so you had to think in a way that was very like collected everyone and brought everyone together on the same journey, but also flexed to whatever their world looked like and their process and their roles.
When was that work? Like, can you think of a time where you're like, okay, this is actually harmoniously working? Did it?
It happened really quickly, actually.
Really?
It shocked me. Yeah. Which is wild. I know. And we saw results in the press and results in Cannes and results in business the following year. So I think it was about a year and a half that it took to like really take off, which is just like, I feel like that's a nod to how much talent was already there and it was just bringing it together.
Yeah.
And like, the beauty of bringing all of them together from all around the world, all these CCOs and ECDs, they could all help each other and then like share knowledge, share resources, and like honestly celebrate each other and help each other grow and be better and grow the ideas was a big part of it. So we saw that translate the next year in Canada. Like, I think we won like 115 Lions and we were named Agency of the Year. And then we also won like 6 global brands that same, I think the next month.
Wow.
Yeah. It was wild.
You hear about the global offerings and that kind of thing. And like the idea is what you're describing.
It's, or
like,
easy to roll your eyes at.
Yeah. And most people would go, that is never going to work.
Totally.
All of those egos, personalities, local nuances, like everything across the board. How do you, like...
You're going to love this.
Okay, how do you do that?
You're going to love this.
Okay.
It relates to the humanity part that I know you really stand for.
Yeah.
Bringing the humanity from people. We focused on making it so much less about competition because it definitely, it's a process that a lot of agencies use and even brands have. Mm. Like, I know Facebook started one before they were Meta, but it's called the Council. I did try to rename it. Didn't fly.
Okay.
But it was definitely a competitive thing before and toxic and really small and elitist. Yeah. And we kind of threw all of that out and changed it into a supportive environment, inspirational environment, and a very human environment. Mm. And it very tangibly, something we started doing, I think Tor had already left. I think this was like 2016 when we started doing this. To introduce yourself to the group, because you had to earn your seat every single time. So we like to keep things fresh and not have it always be the same faces and give opportunity to other people, obviously.
So how would that work? They'd get on the call, like, or the meeting, they'll say, hey, I'm Ollie, I'm known for X, Y, and Z, or like, I...
Oh, dude, we weren't on a call. We were in a room.
In a room?
Somewhere in the world.
Oh, yes.
You're face to face. Remember those days?
Yeah. What the hell is that? That sounds mental.
Yeah.
But okay, so they'd be in the room and they would have to then introduce themselves. Like, if this was today, they'd be on a call. They'd say, like, what would they say?
They had 5 minutes. They were given 5 minutes. They often went over. And they couldn't talk about their resume at all, their CV.
Oh, okay.
So it was all about personal... What makes you who you are? That was my brief to them. What makes you who you are as a person?
What's an example of that? Like,
My God. It got so emotional.
Really?
Oh, yeah. People talked about medical struggles. There was a lot of, like, cancer battles. There was a lot of struggling with mental health at some point. And you have to remember, most of these were men.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of crying going on in these moments because people would really open up. It was beautiful.
That sounds like that would never, I can imagine myself. I run a small company, you know, 15 or whatever people, because we over-indexed on this once.
Yeah.
And I think you probably heard it on the Josh podcast, right?
Yes.
We did group therapy every month and it was so intense. It gets to the point where it's like, we need to just get these like one-to-one sessions sorted because you can over-index because then the thing that's particularly in England, I think British people are generally less positive, I'm going to say, than and that's a very American way of saying negative, right? Once you give someone the platform and permission to be in that place, they kind of get themselves stuck a little bit to go around. But then we're not talking about those kind of people. We're talking about people that usually would have led with ego and would have shouted over each other.
Totally.
And what you're doing is going, right, before anyone does that, describe who you are, good and bad. Mm-hmm. That's genius.
It built trust.
Yeah.
It built so much trust right off the bat. And it happened really quickly.
Wow.
From stuff like that. Yeah.
So I can see now why you look like a gray and go, okay, that was actually it was a transformative time. I can point to that for the rest of my life now. I can go, what did we do differently?
Yeah.
Because you hear a lot of words when it comes to like global offerings, like, oh, we're going to be unified.
The jargon.
Yeah, all the jargon. Integrated, blah.
Yeah.
But this is like, I love that saying, does the promise of your brand match up to the actions of your business?
Mm-hmm.
And the promise of the brand of a global creative offering like Gray has to match up to the actions of what you guys are doing to then integrate those people.
I'm going
to
write this down. Hold on.
The promise of your brand. Does the promise of your brand match the actions of your business? Which like... I don't think anyone would give that much time now. They would just go, what's the quick TLDR on getting these guys together in a room?
Yeah.
Tell me what happened when you started to fall out of love with that then.
Let's see. I mean, I think inherently if you're creative, you're curious and you can get bored.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'd been doing it a long time. And even though I had, like I said, a bunch of different roles, or like you said when you were introducing me, I just kind of felt like I did everything I could do there. So that was probably around 2018. that I started exploring other options. But at the same time, they were very supportive and like growing me and giving me, putting me in the spotlight. And they actually asked me to move to Asia in early 2020. Just for like 6 months, just go like bop around the different markets because I knew them better than most people because I'd been out there. I was traveling 26 times a year for 7 years.
Wow, you missed that part. 26 times a year.
So
wait, hold on. That's more than twice a month.
Yeah, I grouped it. I like, but yes, on average.
Where? Like where?
Everywhere. Everywhere. We never really went anywhere twice except London I'd go to.
Where was your least favorite place?
My least favorite place.
English. Had to.
Oh my God. You're going negative. You're going negative. My least favorite place.
Mm.
Ooh. Well, generally in life travel, Dubai.
Mm.
But work travel, not too different. Singapore.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Mm-hmm. It just feels like a kind of a mall city. There was a few blocks that I liked, but...
It was more a mall city.
Okay. More a mall city. Like a little Dubai. It just, I'm a bit more gritty.
Okay.
A bit less rooftop bars, less malls, less, yeah. But anyway,
back to
I had a point about, you brought up a point, actually, the travel bit, global roles are everywhere. And to your point of like, you can roll your eyes a bit at a global offering.
Mm.
And you can kind of roll your eyes a bit at global roles pretty easily. We often were called like, people would be like, what are you, the cloud? Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
It's a totally fair question. But if to do it really, really well, when it's done really well, like it does have the power to make the results happen, but you have to be out in the world. Like, I think a lot of global people might have the title without going to the markets and spending time with them.
You see that a lot.
Yeah.
And it's more of an elevation thing. A lot of the time they're called a global whatever and they've never even left the country.
Yeah.
So they're just kind of presuming that, you get that a lot in the UK.
Yeah.
And global really means London and a bit of Amsterdam.
Right.
Or, you know, I've been to the US a couple of times. Yeah, just call me global.
Yeah.
No.
No. It's very different.
So then, okay, you fell out of love. We're at that point now. So we're leaving Grey. I'm like, I'm done now. I want to go and see... Is this now when you do a sabbatical?
Mm-mm.
No. Because I still like, this is the most bizarre thing. You're the only person I know that's from New York that's done two over 1 month sabbaticals.
We'll jump to sabbaticals.
Okay. Well, 1 month, like 1 month is kind of, I've seen that a couple of times, but it was more than that, right? You were like, poof.
So I technically did three.
Three? Shit. Bad research.
I know. I did a month, which... Which actually was during, so the Gillette pitch was 9 months long. There was a perfect break in the middle that was a month. We didn't know if we'd go on to the second round.
Mm.
And I was so burnt out. Like we'd been pitching for, I think, 3 months through every weekend, every night, da da da.
Wow.
I believe I was even like super sick through most of it. But anyway, I went to Vietnam and Thailand with friends. They just invited me, another one of those ride the wave moments.
Yeah.
Didn't know what it was going to do to my life. And came back after a month, did the remaining phase of Gillette. Literally felt like I landed in America and was like, what's a conference call? And then did and it's amazing how much your brain can turn off so quickly. But then we won and I instead like they had promoted me to a different job. I think it was creative reputation for New York. But when we won Gillette and their tour took over as global CCO from US president, I went to dinner with him one night and just said, like, God, I had such confidence for being so young. I was like, no hard feelings. I need to go back to Asia. Like, Vietnam is calling.
Okay.
And I was like, no worries if that means that my time here has to end.
Wow.
I know. What was I thinking?
Do you regret this?
No.
No.
No, of course not. Because I felt comfortable asking him because he'd done it.
Okay.
He had done 6 months in LATAM and 6 months in Asia when he was younger.
Okay.
So he understood. So I didn't feel crazy.
Mm.
I probably wouldn't have asked if the person hadn't done it. I would have felt insane. But I said, you know, I'm just like really feel the calling, whatever. And he was like, I'm going to be global CCO, he was like, you know this. It's not announced yet. But you're coming with me onto that team.
Wow.
And so here I am thinking like, I'm going to be fired or like, I'm losing my job. I'm going to Asia. And no, that's not what was happening. So he was like, leave tomorrow if you can and just come back first day of 2014. And we had this dinner on in August.
Wow.
So yeah, I got my shit together and I can swear on here. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool, cool, cool. I got my shit together and I think I left at the end of September or like mid-September. I don't know, it was like four and a half months.
Wow.
And
yeah. With a guarantee role, like that would never happen. That's such a unique situation where
totally
it's like,
unique.
You can come back, you can work. For, that must have been incredible.
It's like find the boss who sees you.
Yeah.
And I mean, he did in so many ways.
If you were Tor sitting here right now.
Hey, Tor.
No, you're Tor. What do you think he, or how would he describe you to another CCO or a friend to say, oh my God, I couldn't do what I do without Rachel because she...
I know what to say to that because I asked him once.
Okay. What did he say?
I like sketched out. I was like, why am I in this position? It was really soon into the global role. And I was like, this is insane. And what was awesome is we were both going into global roles at the same time. So it felt like we had camaraderie in terms of how much it just like blows your mind how big the universe or the world is. How many countries and how many offices and all that stuff. So anyway, we were like... catching up and I just had a sketch on a whole piece of paper of like, why did you put me in this position? What am I supposed to do? What is my goal? And I was like, okay, so I get along with a lot of different people, cross, like communicate with all these different markets, da-da. And he was like, yeah, all of that. But really like you just make shit happen. And that's what he needed because we didn't have a big team. A lot of agencies had like teams of 20 to 30 people. I think I just hit the mic. It was my first time.
What is the inverse of that? So like, is there someone else doing a role that doesn't make shit happen?
Yeah.
Do you know like what else?
Yeah.
That's the purpose of your role in that, you know, your existence in that role. There must be something other than that or something like deeper than that.
I agree.
I'm sure of it.
Like a universal element. Not everyone is built to collaborate across every different country.
Yeah.
Not everyone's made for that.
No.
So I still hold on to that.
I'd like to know more about that. Like what sucks about that? And what was unexpected that you weren't expecting when you were put into that global position?
Oh, the toll on the body.
As in traveling 26 times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Christ.
Yeah. So that's like a literal one. I feel like the way I went into it was very much of the mindset of like, what can I do to help? Like, what do they need from a global network? And I just remember looking at it like, we are not here to lead and tell them what to do or how to do it. We're here to serve them and figure out what's going to help them be successful.
Interesting.
And that can be different cross-market or where the network is at. I would always like every 6 months or so look at like, where are we at as a network? At what point in this journey are we at?
It feels like you're, someone said the other day, a chief listening officer. Like you can't just go in there and be like, you need to do this. This is how we do it in the States. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 da. You've got to go in there and be like, okay, like you guys are different. Tell me how. Like,
Yeah.
That is, I think.
And like strategically approach it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than like, we'll give you everything you want. Yeah. It's more you're mediating between the two. I almost think that there's another element to this, which is your ability to hear deeper in what's going on rather than like someone that's taking a shopping list or like, okay, so you want this and this,
right,
or that's
right.
That. Because I think there's a ton of people that can do that really, really well. And that, I want to get onto like why Bark and how you got into that part because like...
But I have to add on to this.
Yes. Go on, tell me.
Okay. I meant to start off with this, but we just were on a roll. Childhood, it all has so much to do with childhood, right? Like everything we all do as people has so much to do with our upbringing in childhood. And I grew up in a family pretty much of therapists or social workers. My mom is an occupational therapist. My sister founded her own mediation company, wrote two books on it. I believe she's at two, maybe three.
Wow.
My stepdad's a therapist. My brother was an activist slash a bunch of things. All this other stuff, like therapy and talking and listening and deeply listening. It's probably kind of bred into me.
That's so interesting. Okay.
And I love it. And also we were put in therapy at a pretty early age.
Really?
Like 10, 11. There was some home turmoil to deal with.
No, fair enough. I wish I was put in therapy like way younger.
Mm-hmm.
I think like we were saying earlier about, you know, kids wanting to become influencers and that kind of stuff. You could say, yes, go and do that. But before you become this thing that's known by everyone in the world, figure out who you are first. I feel like we film ourselves quickly and get, you know, these kids get themselves out there into the world before they've even understood who they are.
Yeah.
But then there was a counterpoint earlier, which was like, well, who you are doesn't stay the same anyway. That's a transient thing. And that, you know, but it's so important to have people around you that are telling you that, rather than, you can imagine being like an 18-year-old kid that becomes famous on TikTok now. And you would, unless you had good advice or set that therapist, mother therapist, everyone being a therapist, you'd probably think, this is my identity now.
Right.
This is who I am. I have to be this person forever.
And don't so many of us think our work is our identity? And that's like something you kind of have to unravel in your adulthood.
Yes.
You actually reminded me of something about the thought of like advice to your younger self or whatever is like, get to know yourself.
Yeah.
Which takes time.
How do you... Okay, one thing I want to ask you therapy-wise, like, is there a thing that you would ask, or in your head, have you got a way that you would approach meeting somebody to try and get to who they are as quickly as possible?
Ooh. Ooh. Just it, like, anybody or in the work setting?
Yeah, I kind of want to go anybody because for me, okay, in the work setting for me, I always go, like, where are you now? Because figuring out like what they say first, like, okay, well, I'm this, I'm that, or whatever. Where do you want to be? And then what's blocking you from getting into that place? I wouldn't do the same thing if I was speaking to someone like, like on a date. Like, so where are you now? You want to get married? What's blocking that from happening?
But they run for the hills.
Yeah. You know what's really bad? When I was dating, I used to do that.
No.
I used to on dates because I'm like,
Bless your fiance.
What I know, right? But I used to say, like, well, to my team, I was like, you know, if you're a recruiter, you're a therapist or a journalist, right? You find out the information as deeply as you can, understand where it's coming from, and then write about it in a compelling way. I then took that really seriously. So when I went onto dates with girls, I would like literally become a shit therapist, and they'd be like, "What is this guy?"
We've got a knocker.
Oh.
We've got a knocker.
We have a knocker. LJ, we'll just pause here. We're going to pause.
Who's there?
Oh, it's an Amazon delivery.
Oh, cool. We love Amazon delivery.
Yay. Amazon.
Christmas every day.
We can keep that in. That's fine. Yeah. Okay, sorry. So, yeah, like therapy. So back to my question, right? Would you have like a holistic approach to trying to figure out who somebody is quickly on a deeper level? Or is it just, do you do it by feel?
I kind of do it by feel. I mean, I've been told recently I do listen and I ask a lot of questions.
Mm.
I'm definitely curious and like to dig in.
What question do you ask that normally gets like...
I'm not afraid to ask like questions about childhood trauma and stuff like that.
I love
that.
This.
Yeah.
I wish life was just like that. I wish I could meet people and just go, have you ever seen The Invention of Lying with Ricky Gervais?
No.
Oh, it's a great film. The whole concept is that no one is allowed to lie in this film.
Great.
And so like they'll do an interview and be like, I think you're really bad and I would never employ you personally, but good luck, you know. And everyone's just straight down the line. I would love, I think, to live in a world like that. Although
would
I say
we?
That no, I fucking wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. I'm like, I'm a deep people pleaser, and so I rarely ever really say what I'm thinking. We don't need to know every single person's thing going on, so I'm gonna eat my words back on that.
But the awareness that there is stuff going on.
Yeah.
I feel like that was something, maybe it was the therapy at a young age, but I remember being really young being like, well, if I have all this stuff going on and no one knows, then who, I don't know what other people have going on. So that like awareness of everybody's got their stuff.
Which is not very New York of you in a way. Like I feel...
I don't identify as American. Just kidding.
You don't?
Not really.
What do you identify as if not American? You don't know? Just I guess in a global operations role, I identify as the global. Yeah.
Jargon.
I want to get onto Buck before me and you start doing a full blown fucking therapy session. So we leave Gray. We go on.
COVID hit. I was supposed to move to Asia.
Yes.
Didn't. That was with Gray. So then two opportunities came up. One was WPP and one was this tech startup. And I just wanted to try something super different and got on with the CEO really well. And she was a young woman, which I loved, really smart, totally yin to yang background. She came from like finance and tech startup world.
Wow.
Yeah. And we like, we just changed everything about this tech startup within a year and a half. It was really fun. But I could go on and on about that. But at the end of that, I was like, okay, now I need a break just because I intentionally don't want to work right now. Mm. It wasn't so much like a, I need to go travel and see the world. I need to find myself or whatever. Maybe it was just COVID pandemic stuff or a mix of everything. But I took a year off.
Wow.
That was the other sabbatical.
A year?
A year. I didn't plan for a year.
That's amazing. Wait, so you tech startup, which again, we could like, I'm sure we could speak about a lot. Mm-hmm. Like,
oh yeah. So much there.
I can imagine just, yeah. Also in a post-COVID world as well, where, what was it?
It was like in COVID. Like, yeah. Really, I think I started that in 2020 or maybe, yeah.
So three things are happening there. Number one, it's a tech startup. So that means you have no life anymore. This is a baby. Mm-hmm. It's your baby. Mm-hmm. Grow this thing. Mm-hmm. Number two, nobody had got used to hybrid working.
Totally.
So it was 9 a.m. meeting. Cool. Maybe mm-hmm. lunch at the laptop. Finish.
I had to change the settings on my Google to make sure I had a 10-minute window to go to the bathroom.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So that, like, I'm adding up a little cocktail called burnout, and it's coming soon, right? So without even knowing what the company was about, startup to put post-COVID, and also just knowing your nature and knowing that you get shit done and you're determined. There's also this kind of identification with, holy shit, I've got to do the thing, my superpower, which is show up for this thing the whole time. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine there were different parts of you that were going, you need to do this because it's a thing that you don't know about. And the way that you prove yourself is by outworking everybody else. So I can see where you got to a year and a half of that and went, fuck this for a bag of spanners.
Totally. And the work harder than, not harder than everyone else. I think everyone, you know, in a tech startup, we were small, we were 25 people, everyone's working. But like, because I was MD, partner to the CEO, and to like set an example, you know, like you're like responsible for 25 people and they're looking at you. And so I just felt like, you definitely had to give it your all.
That's weird, by the way. Because we had this thing where we, this presenteeism thing, like.
This what thing?
Presenteeism. It's
presenteeism.
Presenteeism is like, just like. Being there to show that you're present and for the sake of being like, look, I'm working really hard, but actually you're doing nothing. You're probably on Vinted or some whatever, right? So we had unlimited holiday at Unknown, okay? And it was like this.
Had past tense?
Had, exactly. And I'll tell you why it was had. Uh-huh. I weirdly got invited onto Bloomberg to speak about this. It was mental.
Amazing.
Weird, right? But the reason I bring it up is because unlimited holiday, okay, what do you think happens there generally? Number one, humans like tokens. We like to know how many things we have. If your mum gives you $20 to go out, you're going to spend all of it. Mm-hmm. If she gave you a blank check and said, enjoy the night, you're probably not going to spend anything. Like, who knows what that, where does that stop and start?
Yeah, the unknown.
So I think, exactly. Uh-huh. Wow. That happens a lot.
I didn't mean to do that.
So the idea of unlimited, I don't think humans like that. It's a really clever thing that Goldman Sachs used and said, look, you know, everyone gets unlimited holiday.
Was it Goldman Sachs? I thought Netflix started it.
Everyone did it. Just in the creative world. Goldman Sachs did it way later. And the reason why I went on to Bloomberg didn't in the end, because I ended up getting drunk in Marbella. And that's
right, you've got to do
it. I know. It was stupid. There was a guy with a boat and it was funny. Anyway, I wrote this thing and said, we're going to stop doing unlimited holiday. As it happened on the same day that Goldman Sachs announced they were starting it.
Oh my God.
So then I was pitched against this global CEO of fucking Goldman Sachs to be like, why do you think Goldman Sachs shouldn't do unlimited holiday?
Oh my God.
I run a company of sub 20 people. I don't know what this is like. But, and the truth is, like, you rise to the level of your highest performer. And if you're looking around and you see that the highest performer has taken 3 days holiday, guess what you're doing? Mm. Taking three. And any more than that, you are working less hard than that person, which is really odd. Nick, I think this comes from the whole industrial age of working. My hours equal my worth, and therefore that's why I'm valuable.
Yeah.
As a managing director or a CEO to a business, you should not be working the same amount of hours as everybody else.
Yeah.
In fact, you should be seen to be working less, because the other time you're thinking about where the direction of the business should go. But we don't like that concept here, which I think is really strange, particularly in New York compared to anywhere else.
Yeah, New York is crazy.
But anyway, so that was a tangent. But when you mentioned like I had to be seen to be working harder or like as hard as everybody else, I just think that's interesting, because I think that's a thing that's changed since that time.
I don't know if I wonder. I mean, it was definitely back-to-back meetings, but I wonder if I was working, like showing, they wouldn't have known because it was remote. They wouldn't have known if I was working crazy hours. But in the output, so I did a lot of like communicating cross-department to show the value of each department so that finance understood creative decisions, creative understood finance decisions, da, da, da. And really, I think they felt that value. And whatever else we were, I mean, we worked on so much. We changed like the team, the model, the structure, the client roster, the way we bill. Like we shut down the entity. We opened a new one. Like we did so much in a year and a half.
Wow.
Cleaned out 20 out of 23 people and brought on some new ones. So that took an emotional toll, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, that must have been really hard.
Really hard.
Wow.
Really, really hard. That definitely helped with the burnout.
I was going to say, that's okay. That's like the fourth component to our little mixed school burnout, right?
Mm-hmm.
The emotional.
Yeah.
And I think at that time as well, a lot of people were going through really similar times.
Yeah.
Minus maybe the other two or three, including startup and post-COVID.
Yeah.
Okay. So then.
I want to add, I did it financially responsibly. I Airbnb'd the hell out of my apartment, which I don't even think I'm legally allowed to do anymore.
Not anymore, no. No.
Yeah.
I'm crazy. Reporting this, actually.
So. Yeah. It's too bad because it really helped me take a year off.
Yeah.
But I really thought I'm going to take 3 months and then see how I feel.
Yeah.
And I thought that I'd be ready. Nope. I did start talking to Buck at that point. I think it was the end of 3 months.
But you weren't ready to go back in?
No. And they, like, it was such a slow interview process anyway.
Yeah.
Like, it was, I'll talk about it, but it worked out really well for both in terms of being long.
Yeah.
Because I was definitely not in a mindset to start working after 3 months.
How did you know that you weren't?
In my soul, in my heart.
Really?
Yeah. I just don't get bored.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would do. I've always thought about this, like launching a business and running it for 5 years.
Yeah.
You're on. And even if you're away, you're on. Like,
yeah.
I don't know what I would actually do or how I would approach not being on. I would have this fear in the back of my head.
Like, totally. It's like the fear people have when they talk about retirement.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's, I know that that can be really scary.
Yeah.
It's like, what is your value? What are you going to do? What's your identity?
Why not another ad agency?
Mm. So many reasons. Had a great time in agency life and I wouldn't venture to say I'll never go back or I would never go back. There's a lot that they can do really, there's a lot of creativity that stretches beyond what people outside of Adland think ad agencies do. And it's brilliant. Like I was part of a team that helped make a product and huge activations and like really culture shifting work and just stuff that was kind of went everywhere. And people, like I remember one of the last things that Gillette did while I was there ended up being taught in school curriculums. So it's an ad about Me Too movement. And I heard like several school girls. Anyway, just crazy the impact that some of this like Adland work can have is pretty wild. The opportunities that came inbound, there were maybe a couple agencies in the mix, but mostly weren't. And I could talk about what they were. But even just considering it, I just had a really hard time getting excited.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's because I was in it for like 14 years and all, you know, being at Gray when it was number one in the US and then number one in the world for 3 years when I was on the global team. And so it's kind of like, what's the exciting thing to reach for?
Yeah.
What's the mountain to climb?
Particularly when it's the mountain's a lot smaller than
the
it was.
Mountain's a lot smaller. The mountain is sliding. it's a weird time and it's weird for all creative companies. And I mean, frankly, like probably all companies with AI in the conversation and stuff. But I just had I definitely thought about it because there were agency jobs popping up.
Mm.
Actually, I said it to the CEO of Buck, Emily, an Australian woman. She's awesome. And when I took the job, instead of said to her, 50% of my company so well, because they run a really, really ethical company and very talent focused, like not just saying it, not jargon. And I just felt like I've never heard a reputation the way I've heard about Buck inside, outside. It's freaking crazy, which I can also say more about. But the agency thing, I've never, even being in one that was at the top, and I don't think anyone I've ever known who's worked in an agency would say, this is the best run company. Or like the best run ethical or moral company, or like treats its people really, you know, like that's just not the story.
How does she do, like, so I'm curious.
Yeah, there's
about
so many
this.
Questions.
Like,
I mean.
how long you've been there for?
like 8 months, 8 months, 9 months.
Wow. Okay.
I know. I'm brand new in the buck world.
I want to know, like, what have you seen? Like, what is different to even how Gray was run?
So much. So much is different. Buck is not an agency. And I'm say this with full awareness that I've been out of agencies since 2020. Mm. So I'm sure that a lot have adapted to some extent, but I know enough people in ad land that they haven't adapted that much. Yeah. there's a lot of hierarchy, and Buck does not function that way. Like the way that if the CCO is involved or the CDO, so we have a CCO and a CDO, Kevin and Ben, also awesome. If they're involved, they're contributing to the work. Like they are doing the work with the team.
Not judging.
They are not coming in to like lightly sprinkle on some like polish or blow it up at the end. Like the value point of trust is insane. Like the way that they are trusted by brands, I've never heard of anything like it. The way they're trusted by the freelance network. When I actually started and started putting post-its on my wall, just being like, because I think I had like 72 intro meetings when I started, 30-minute Zooms, 72 of them. And I just started putting post-its on the wall of like things that I heard, common words that I heard, common phrases. Trust was the number one word. And it was, that was internal people, but I also ended up like a lot of my friends have gone to client side. So they're at Google and Spotify and Airbnb and Apple. And those are all our top clients, plus like Microsoft and IBM. And it's like the best client roster you could imagine. Wow. And a lot of my friends have gone client side, and they, even if they haven't particularly worked with Buck, they know of it so much so that it's just like, they know that if you hand over something to Buck, it's going to be delivered like in the best way.
I'm really confused.
Their reputation is crazy.
It's weird to get that externally and internally, because normally if you go like a client goes, oh yeah, Buck will get it sorted, someone at Buck's getting burnt, right? That's generally totally how the agency model has worked.
Yeah.
We can give you the most incredible service.
Yeah.
Well, we heard something earlier, which was Flintstones inside, Jetsons on the outside. Or I forget that I've already lost that quote now. But like what I mean by that is like some side is going to lose when you're promising trust on either side. How, and maybe you can't answer this, I don't know if you can, but like what do you think fundamentally, if we're not calling the agency, what are we calling
them? I would call them, I was thinking about it earlier, like they're a design company at their core.
Okay.
Like everything that they make is beautiful. Sometimes I say they because I'm so new.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get used to saying we.
So
they're a design company at their core that like, it's the most trusted design company that you've never heard of. Because like 95% of what we do is NDA. So there is definitely stuff I can't say.
Oh, okay.
But
right.
That's what builds the trust. It's like we take the NDA so seriously.
Okay.
Everything, so much of the work is black boxed. There's code names for almost everything. It is really like, because we're working on some of like biggest tech in the world doing some of these like really proprietary projects.
Well, you've named Apple, Microsoft, IBM. Like these guys are against each other.
Yeah.
So like
we are not AOR model. We're all project based, and because we're a production partner by like legacy, we don't really run into the conflict issue.
Why not? Like, so what? There are different rooms happening, or like
there are different rooms.
Somebody not be working on both at the same time?
The teams have to be separate. It's all managed very, very carefully. Even when we're just talking to each other internally, I'm not allowed to say what the code names are, but we will use code names.
So I could be like, I'm on the sofa project and you're on the chair project.
Yeah.
When you say, I'm sorry, I did not know this.
It is hilarious. I mean, I'm still learning the
language. This sounds like Star Wars. Like what?
It's crazy.
How do you, tell me the level of secrecy. I need to know like, what would you say? Like, what can you say about what you're working on?
I can talk. I mean,
I'm not asking you to speak about the stuff that you're working on. I feel like I work at Buck now.
I know. it's pretty incredible. And I'll talk about like the fun that comes in from the challenge of how you talk about a company that really can't talk about itself very much. I freaking love that brief. But anyway, the stuff like I can say, we have made stuff that if you are an iPhone user, you use it every day. As a language.
Wow, okay.
And we are the, like, we are the brainchild of certain filters that you've used for certain big tech companies. I am going to have to send this to my head of comms.
Okay.
Like, Justin, tell me what has to be cut out. And what I can talk, actually, I asked him a couple nights ago, is more about like the briefs we get in, which I think is really telling about how Buck, how trusted Buck is and how they think. So like Google asked Buck in 2023 to help think about what the future of the Google search is. Like, how do people engage with it? And we were asked by this company in Japan. They're thinking about building a microcity around entertainment and what entertainment means to humans in 2035. And they want a thought partner on how to concept that.
Wow.
And I can say, without naming the brand, something that we did actually already make was a partnership between a big tech company and museums, starting in London, actually, and moving over to New York City now, to bring accessibility to culture. We created an AR version of these museums.
Wow.
So it's all about accessibility to culture.
That is, I didn't know any of this stuff.
There's so much.
Weirdly, in my head, I had, like, Buck is quite production focused.
So it started that way 20 years ago.
And it sounds like it's traveled up the, what I find unique about that, and I didn't know that, which is quite embarrassing because I run a creative recruitment company.
No one would know.
But I also know Alex Beck really well.
Yeah, love him.
You guys
so
acquired.
Much.
It's nice that, like,
yeah.
That's
a whole other thing.
That's
residence.
Another thing. Yeah, resident. Yeah, right. So, like, but you never see production, like, I hate to do the hierarchical thing, but like, production is at the end of the scale.
Oh, we talk about the funnel all the time.
The funnel, right. Yeah. Okay, so let's say we have a funnel. Yeah. And for anyone that is new to this world, I think for a long time, the top of the funnel used to be ad agencies, right?
We talk about it constantly.
I know this has changed. And this is what we were speaking earlier about with Code and Theory, right? Because TV, print, radio, those are three mediums. That's where we broadcast all of our information. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I'll speak to the CMO. Thank you very much. That's changed.
Yep.
And I think the person that's taken that position is more design agencies, design consultancies, transformation consultancies, that kind of stuff, right?
You're speaking my language, Ollie.
Okay, great. But never have you seen, at least in my eyes, a production-focused business in new money that's media monks or monks, even newer money. In old money, it'll be Tag or Williams Lee or one of those businesses. You'd never see that kind of business travel up the client tree and become a design thought partner.
Yep.
How the fuck does
I
that happen?
No. But it's like, been wild to learn about. Yeah, I know. I mean, they started production 20 years ago and they just attracted, and partly because they treat their people so well, have attracted all this incredible talent over the years. And they built out design, I want to say around 10 years ago.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that. And then strategy around 6 years ago. And gaming is another area that started an originals section. Like, they've built into all these different areas, partly because they're getting all this opportunity. Either they're getting opportunity from clients and clients are asking to do different types of work. And that's, so they're very good at kind of, from those trusted relationships, building out around the asks that come in from that trust. And then also to create opportunity because they want to explore other opportunity, they invest in certain areas. So they invested in building their own game, video game, and now they've signed with a major streaming platform that I probably can't say to make a video game together. So through the trust that they've built with their clients, they've been growing in. I call it like this weird amoeba thing.
Yeah.
It grows into tentacles. But they absolutely, through the design and strategy practice over the last 6-7 years, have gone up to that top part of the funnel.
It's like, genuinely, and you've told that, I've not given you much time to tell that story, but that is
we're running out.
We are running out of time, but that is unbelievable. Like, I didn't know, when I speak to my team, I'm like, you guys have these guys completely wrong. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on that we don't know about.
What I'm so excited about, like, my role is being like, my brief to myself is don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
Because they are so good.
Yeah.
And like, it is figuring out the small changes to make that can allow them to grow in the right way for them.
Yeah.
That's basically my role. And what I love is like being able to find the stories that already exist, because the story of Buck is such a story. Mm. Like, you didn't know it. No, how would you? It's not really out there. They're so humble. That's like part of what's beautiful about it. Yeah. They're so humble. So I just like love the idea of uncovering that story.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I think next time we're back, we'll do this and we'll bring in your co-founders and your Emily and everybody else. And we'll have, you can facilitate instead of me. last question before we go, because I know we're being pushed. And this is
there's so much more to say.
I know, it's a fluffy one as well. So unless you can completely sap me off on answering this question and say something else. But this is more about 21-year-old you, because I feel like with the therapy that you have done, you'll have some sort of answer potentially for this. But if you were to see 21-year-old Rachel in front of you right now, entering this industry or entering the horse jump, whatever you were doing at that time, what would you say to her now?
The get to know yourself as fast as you can. Like, I know it's not supposed to be a fast process, but like that question that everyone gets asked in interviews of your strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
We all hate that question.
Yeah.
But it helps you so much figure out what you want to do when you actually own both of those things.
Yeah.
Like embrace the weakness. The industry specifically is such a unique moment right now. I kind of think it's fascinating to me of like the split of the industry. And I feel like it's dividing into kind of the way fashion has of like mass production, factory style, to then boutique, design, craft, quality. And I guess as a 21-year-old, it's like, think about what side you want to be on. Because I feel like that split is growing. I feel like I've been seeing that split for like 8 years.
That's really good advice. Rachel, thank you so much. You're incredible.
You smashed this. Great.
Thank you. Awesome. Are we good, Remy? Muchas gracias. Wow, well done.
Thanks.